our idea of a beautiful life, if I may say so, is an isolated life where you have your career, you have your house, you have your green. And I think green is great. I live a couple blocks from the woods, but we don't think more than that. So we've basically thought of happiness as being alone.
Yeah.
And then you wonder, being alone, or at least your household being alone, but to some extent, it's about just being alone. And then you wonder why we have loneliness, despair, mistrust. It's all actually natural. We've created a society that promotes these things, and then you wonder how we ended up with them.
I'm Brandon Vaidyanathan, and this is Beauty at Work, a podcast about how beauty shapes our world and the work that we do. In this season, we're looking at beauty in science. This episode is sponsored by Templeton Religion Trust and the Institute for Advanced Catholic Studies at the University of Southern California. More about them later in the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our new episode. I'm so thrilled to have my guest today, Dr. Seth Kaplan. Seth is a leading expert on fragile states. He's a professorial lecturer in the Paul Nitze School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. He's a senior advisor for the Institute for Integrated Transitions and consultant to organizations such as the World Bank, U.S. State Department, U.S. Agency for International Development, and OECD, as well as developing country governments and NGOs. Seth has published several books, the latest of which is Fragile Neighborhoods, which comes out October 17th. Seth, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. Such a pleasure to have you.
No, thank you so much. It's a great privilege and an honor to be with you today, Brandon.
Fantastic. Listen, you have such an incredibly rich background. You've worked in for-profit, non-profit, and government spaces around the world. You've traveled to 70 countries. What was your childhood like? Did you travel a lot growing up?
I would say there's two things that marked my childhood that that have impacted me a lot since. One was that when I was very small, we traveled a lot. I lived overseas for a year. Went to Scandinavia, and these were the days when it wasn't so easy to travel. So we went, we did travel Puerto Rico, Hawaii, Scandinavia, parts of Europe, lived a year in Israel. And then we stopped, and I didn't go anyplace for 10 years except visiting family, long car trips. So something about that early childhood, and then I think the stopping must have stayed in my mind, because the first chance I got to go overseas, I went. And then the bug got in me and I just kept going and going. The second part of my childhood, which I think was even more important because I focus on relationships. I focus on social dynamics in everything I do. And as a child, I had a really, really hard time catching up with the basic social dynamics of my peer group. I couldn't speak until I was five. I stuttered until I was in college. I had several years, seventh, eighth grade in particular, where I was bullied. I even changed schools after seventh grade because the bullying was so bad. I mean, I was the person who was watching what was going on and not easily catching up with what was going on. If you have ever seen those kids, intellectually smart, but socially not on top of things, maybe as much as somebody else. And that sort of, you could say that scarred me. But you also could say that it taught me very early on to, one, appreciate the importance of relationships and social dynamics, and two, taught me that to watch, to study, to learn, to try to understand. And then when I basically got to college, went to Turkey for a summer, and then when I finished college, just about the first place I went was Africa, and then I spent time in Nigeria, and through those eyes that I had developed as a child, immediately I begin to read and see things which stayed with me so much later when I focused on countries and did work on fragility and peace building. Those eyes were very different eyes than most people had.
Yeah. What led you to Africa?
I went to Africa for a couple of reasons. One is I had a chance to meet a lot of people. When I was a student in college, I was a member of an organization called ISEC, ISEC had these international conferences, and I had been involved in them. I met people from a lot of places, like 50, 60 countries around the world. And Africans always stood out to me as, again, they're very relational. They're very different in terms of culture from my own. I always found them very warm, among the warmest people I could meet. And I have consistently been attracted to warm people and warm cultures. And something about Africa, just that whole dynamic was so unusual, yet so rewarding. It wasn't like a conscious, like intellectual choice. It was like, this is a place I have to go and see. And when I got there, I was in Kenya originally. I asked my African friends, where should I go in Africa and spend an extended period of time? And many of them said, go to Nigeria. And when I asked why, they said, even for us, it's a cultural experience. Because if you know anything about Africa, Nigeria is quite different than most parts of Africa. Very intense, very competitive, very in your face. Loads of governance problems, but very rich society in terms of social relationships. I just didn't go to Africa. I went to Nigeria and I lived there for a period of time.
Okay. Wow. Wow. And you've lived in China as well for an extended period? And
I lived in China. I lived in Japan. I lived in Turkey. Again, I've been in Israel many times. And I'm a big believer of wandering. And I'm a big believer of spending time. And I'm coming from the West. I always found Europe, it is beautiful. It is nice. It's not so different. I wanted to go to the places that were different, the places that would teach me something, the places that were also warmer, socially warmer. I mean, I work on fragile states, which is the more extreme version, because people are very warm and they can't depend on the government. But I would just say in general, I found non-Western countries more stronger human relationships, more warmer, and something about that just was very attractive. So I lived in these places, but they were specifically chosen for something about their culture that I was appealing to me every time.
Yeah. That's really fascinating. You know, I grew up in the Middle East, as you know, and mostly in Oman and in Dubai, and then a little bit in India. And then when I came over to Canada for college, the thing that struck me immediately was the coldness of social life.
Coldness. It's so cold. I mean, the United States, I mean, there people will smile at you, but it's very transactional.
Yeah,
you have to go to some specific pockets are warmer, but it's so cold. I can remember a famous trip I took when I was in college. I had maybe right after college, I lived in Turkey as a student. I went back to Turkey after I graduated. I was doing some travel, and then I traveled to Europe by bus, actually. And I wrote this letter how not only did the weather change from the Middle East to Europe, but the human relationships had all changed when I went from the Middle East to Europe. And this is like I was 21 years old and exactly the same feeling you just described.
Yeah. Incredible. So how did you get into the study of fragile states? What led to that?
Imagine that in your 20s, you wander, you explore. Everywhere I wandered, I'm reading. I would read a lot. I studied countries. I studied, I don't know, everything from political philosophy, economics. I mean, I just like intellectual and physical wandering. And at one point, I mean, I have an MBA. I started a company in China. I ran a business. So I did all that. And at some point I said, this is the wrong direction. And I'm like 30 years old. I had learned Japanese. I had learned Chinese. I had started a company. And I just decided business is not for me. Then I had the big question, what do I do? And I took some time off. Basically, I don't think I had a choice. I took some time off because I knew this wasn't the right choice. I wanted to sell my business. I came back to America. I had like a year or a year and a half where I'm just thinking. And I think the reason I went to fragile states is because I looked at what I knew and I looked at what interests me and I looked what kept me up at night. And the question that kept me up at night more than anything else was, why do some states work better than others? And the biggest contrast was I moved from Nigeria to Japan. And just think about the societies. Japan is the most cohesive, large country, 120 million people, very cohesive. You can find smaller countries that are more cohesive, but there's nothing on that scale. And here you have Nigeria now with over 200 million, ethnically divided, religiously divided, low-level violence, some places severe violence, every election you don't know what's going to happen, loads of corruption. What a contrast. And so that contrast stayed in my head. And the question kept occurring to me, why do some states work better than others? And I would read all the literature and I would say, something is wrong in this literature. It's missing some very important elements. And this is, by now, it's 2004, 2005, 2006. And what are people thinking about it, asking questions about it? Where after 9/11, the question of fragile states had come up. And that seemed like a very natural way for me to apply my knowledge and try to take a practical turn for my intellectual wandering and do something that interests me, places I enjoyed, but also places which I thought the whole debate about how do we help these countries or how do we nurture a better trajectory for them. I just found it to be very technical and missing the most foundational elements, which is the nature of their relationships, their cohesion, their social dynamics. So I went because of interest. I went because it made sense based on what I knew. But I also went that direction because I thought that the whole discussion around it was quite missing very important details.
Yeah. So what would you say are the biggest insights you've learned from that work on fragile states?
I think the most important thing, which I took that same insight and applied it to the United States when I wrote my current forthcoming book, is this idea that relationships matter. Social dynamics matter. Country, we talk about politics, we talk about economics, we talk about institutions, we talk about elections, but on a very, very foundational level, the nature of how a country works and how successful they are in these various spheres or sectors is all about relationships. Countries that have strong relationships, have strong institutions, they're able to promote better functioning governments. They're able to promote economic development. They're able to be peaceful. And the places that have poor relationships, and we can discuss what that actually means, are much more likely to be conflict prone, much more likely to be underdeveloped, much more likely to be high political risks, and so on and so forth. So for me, it's you always start when you look at a country and what is the nature of the relationships and the institutions that support or shape those relationships?
No, that's super important. And you say in your book, I mean, obviously the United States is not so much the state, but society that's fragile, right? And I wonder if you see that the increasing fragility of American society might be contributing to the future fragility of the American state.
I mean, ultimately, yes, because what happens in society affects what is going to happen in politics and economics. I think the United States is a country with pretty strong institutions, national institutions, state, the local state, civil society. So I would say it will take significant time for the country to deteriorate. I mean, this is not Nigeria. This is not Somalia. This is not Syria, Libya, and so on and so forth. But ultimately, when you see the political instability we have, I would say, and we have problems with the government debt, and we have problems with deaths of despair and the amount of pain and suffering we see in society, alienation, mistrust, all of these things must ultimately not end well for the country. It's a question of the degree it would have to reach for it to have really, really large impact on the larger picture.
Yeah, you've pointed out, you know, as you did right now, and your book is filled with a number of fairly alarming statistics about the fragility of American society and the signs of decay. How did you decide to focus on the neighborhood as central? What makes neighborhoods so important?
Neighborhoods are important. Let's take a step back. When I focus on fragile states, the most important relationships are the relationships at the national level between different groups in society. And so I think if you go to a local community in a fragile state, you often have very strong cohesion, strong families, strong local institutions. What you have is you have no mechanism for different parts of society to cooperate. Mm. And therefore, the relationships that matter is between the different parts or segments of society. You come to the United States and you look, and the national institutions seem very vibrant, very thick set of institutions. I mean, you're in Washington, you almost think there's too many institutions. Right. There's so many think tanks. I mean, I can run into a new think tank and someone starting a new think tank. I mean, there must be hundreds, and advocacy and legal and lawsuits and courts, and it's just, and the media, it's such a rich on a certain level institutional landscape. But if you look beneath the surface, and you always must look beneath the surface, and you always must start when you analyze a country by going amongst the people, it's very dangerous to understand a country from the capital. Mm. It's very dangerous to understand the country from the top down, from just at the elite or top political social leadership level, because that is not a country. Those are elements that are making the news. Those are the phone numbers or the addresses you're going to get if you're asking who do you go meet in that country. But that's not telling you a lot about what actually is going on in the country. Those might be more reflections on what's underneath, but often it could be very divorced. So when I think about America, I want to go and wander the country. I wandered the world. So I took another journey. My journey was a journey into America, and wandered around. And I think what you see repeatedly is that you see that a lot of good stuff happens nationally, but there's been a great loss in terms of the local dynamism and the social institutions and the sense of community. And there's a great void actually between the individual and the state. And I think a lot of the problems we see in the country is because of that emptying out or that thinning out, or you might call it a deinstitutionalization of social life. Mm. And that's not true everywhere. It's more true in some places than other places. And that's not only a poor rich dichotomy, because some wealthy places, everyone is in their house, nice and comfortable, but they don't know any of their neighbors and they're all socially isolated. And they're afraid to show any vulnerability. And so I would just say that I focus on neighborhoods because neighborhoods are the only entry point that I can, the only lens, the only entry point in which I can examine that micro level dynamic and see what is happening in people's lives. And I can compare this neighborhood to that neighborhood, and we can say that neighborhood is thriving. This neighborhood is full of problems. So if we want to understand the micro or the granular level challenges facing relationships in America, and I'm not talking about the intergroup, which is what I think a lot of people in the political science or activist field might talk about because they worry about polarization. If you talk about the relationships as the average American is experiencing them, you have to go to the street level, the household level, the street level, the neighborhood level. And so I focus on neighborhoods because that's the easiest, in fact, the only way to go deep and to really understand that what I think is the problem that's upstream from all the other social problems we're having in the country, or the great majority. I hate to say but everything from drug overdose to problems of social mobility, to problems of mistrust and polarization. It all goes back to something has changed in the nature of relationships.
In the neighborhood, at the neighborhood level.
In the neighborhood. Well, I would say in the home, on the street, in the neighborhood. The neighborhood is the lens.
Yeah.
But when I include that, I would also say something has changed in the house, in the family.
Right.
Interfamily networks, community, school. Community relationships, and even the physical landscape. I mean, if you have foreign eyes, and I have foreign eyes, and you look around America, the landscape is physically built to isolate people. If you really think about it, it's not mm-hmm. physically built to bring people together, which was the case for most of human history. It's physically built to everyone has their nice, materially well-off little plot of land, and then there's no interaction between anybody else. So it's actually physically designed to isolate people from each other. It's kind of scary when you begin to pay attention.
Yeah, yeah. And you notice, I mean, in your, you know, one of the most alarming statistics I saw is that two U.S. neighborhoods can differ in life expectancy by as much as 41 years. How does that happen?
I mean, it happens because the social context, I mean, clearly there's a material element. There's no good supermarket down the street. You don't have work. And over there, they have much more money. So clearly there is a material element. But for me, the most, I put the material aside and I focus only on the social. And I think the social is much more important. It can, it, the difference can be is you have a stable home you live in. You could be, you have friends in your neighborhood. It could be because you're in, you basically have places to walk. You have less pollution. So you have all these elements that are affecting the healthiness of a place. But I think the most important is what we might call the social, I call it the social habitat. Hmm. If you're in a place with a really strong social habitat, you're going to be, you're not only going to have friends, you're going to have strong relationships. You're going to have supporting relationships. You're going to feel secure every day. You're going to have, you're going to participate, contribute to, have access to institutions that not only do you have ownership and you're an active member of, but also that it's there to help you, support you. So I think that big difference, a lot of it is explained by the type of social structures, social habitat around you, and how that affects your well-being and affects your well-being on so many different levels.
Yeah, yeah. Could you contrast, and you've sort of done this at the moment, but if you could contrast a fragile neighborhood with what might be considered a beautiful neighborhood, and I don't mean aesthetically, but relationally, right? What are the ingredients of that kind of a beautiful neighborhood? What is the ideal to which you want to move us to?
I think there's many parts of America that have beautiful neighborhoods, but I can just speak from my own personal experience. I live in a neighborhood when my family moved out of New York City, after I got married, I lived in Brooklyn. And we literally spent a couple of years checking out neighborhoods, going south. I knew I had to come to Washington. I didn't know I'd be living in Washington. I didn't know I'd be teaching at Johns Hopkins. But I knew that I'd be doing something in Washington. So I looked south. So I looked in neighborhoods in New Jersey. I looked at two neighborhoods around Philadelphia. My wife and I spent time looking at neighborhoods, and we didn't have a clear idea where we wanted to go. We have some options. So we checked them out, and then somebody recommended my particular neighborhood. And my neighborhood, I would say, is beautiful is a really good term, but the term that I would use, it's joyful. I mean, I argue in my book that we want to create a country where everyone lives in a flourishing neighborhood. So my neighborhood is flourishing, but the feeling I get when I walk down the street in my neighborhood is a feeling of joy. It's a feeling of joy because there's lots of kids. The kids are on the street. It's a feeling of joy because I can look in the homes of my neighbors and I know who lives there. I know something about them. I feel like I belong in this place. Because I live at 910, so I can tell you 900 is rental. So I don't actually 910 on my street. 900 is rental, so I know who lives there. Don't know them so well. 901, my wife knows. 903 is the person who's easily the most generous, giving in terms of helping individuals who are lonely. She goes around every week and visits people who live alone and the elderly. She just does her own initiative and she starts up lots of things. 905, the guy is really funny. You could do without some of his jokes, but he's very funny. 907, whatever. The point is, and I could talk about the neighbor right next to us who's got three kids and plays with my kids because we share a backyard and they're using my stuff and I'm using their stuff and my kids are always in their home when they're bored with us. So I could just go and say, but I could do that on the other street to a certain extent and I can walk for blocks and every block I know people. And my wife would know more. And we know what kids they have. We know what school they go into. My wife could even tell you what's wrong with their kitchen renovation. So the point is, what is a joyful neighbor? A joyful neighbor is that you know a lot of people. You have a lot of relationships. You feel like you mean I go to a synagogue in my neighborhood, but also I have restaurants I go here. I have people who I can just greet on the street. So there's a couple of parks where my kids can regularly go to. My daughter, who's the oldest, she's 11. She wants to go and walk to friends from school. She can go and walk to friends from school. Probably 2/3 of her classmates are within 20, 25 minutes walking. So a joyful, what you might call a beautiful neighborhood, is a neighborhood where you know lots of people, where you feel that you have a stake in the neighborhood, where you want to pick up the trash when you see it on the road, when you have institutions you're volunteering for, and you have restaurants or supermarkets you're going to, and I can't go to a restaurant and not see faces that I know. I may not say hi every time, but I will go meet someone for coffee, and we will never be an hour in that place without somebody stopping by and saying hello. A real neighborhood in terms of what this is, how life used to be for everybody. It's only in the last 60 years that we've created a landscape that basically prevents this from happening. But a joyful neighborhood that for me is beautiful is something to do with the relationships, something to do with the places I can go and meet people, something to do with the fact that there's lots of kids and the kids are in the parks and all these things. Again, it's all about some sort of social vitality, some sort of, I think, ownership and belonging to the place, that this is my home. And I know other people who live in my home or my little society here. That to me creates joy. It creates satisfaction. It creates a sense of security. And I feel that most Americans don't have that. And I'll just say one more thing, because the neighborhood is very rich in local institutions. I mentioned religious. I mentioned like restaurants and some shopping, which are owned by people more or less in the neighborhood. But we also have like some sort of associations that help poor people in my neighborhood, just in our neighborhood. We have civic associations that come around and talk about planning. One of the traffic lights I know was a real pain in the neck, the way it was organized. People petitioned. I have a neighbor who's on the security, whatever the security committee of the county. So the point is, we have all these institutions. We have all this engagement with the rest of society, but all through the lens of our neighborhood. So it works on so many levels that this is a very socially vital place. And that is beautiful. At least the term I want to use is joyful.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. Fantastic. I think that characterizes the neighborhood I live in too. And it's not a common experience for a lot of Americans, right?
Not a common experience. It might be a common experience for people around the world, not in the United States. And I don't think in most of the developed world today at all, actually. Yeah. But the United States is an extreme version. But yes, if you have that, you just know that you feel something more secure and more happy about your daily life because you just feel you're a part of something. And if you need something, I'll give it one more example. I can recall there was a time when my oldest dropped her younger brother and dropped him on the cement and his on the chin, and he was bleeding on the chin. It sounds pretty awful. My wife, who's very good in emergencies, picked him up and took off down the street without ever telling the two of us, because I have a third child, but not then. And he was very small then, took off. And we just left us, and we had no idea where she went. And she came back a half an hour later. Where did she go? She knew the house with the closest nurse. Mm. And in fact, for various reasons, we could identify houses with 7 or 8 nurses or doctors in our neighborhood. So she went three blocks away. There was a nurse and immediately wanted to have him checked out and told what to do. So imagine, can the people who are listening to this or watching this, are you able to say that if you have an emergency, you know where to run in your neighborhood to get help? If you live in a thriving neighborhood, the answer should be yes.
Yeah, yeah.
You're listening to Beauty at Work. This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Templeton Religion Trust as part of a grant on the aesthetic dimensions of science. Templeton Religion Trust supports projects as well as storytelling related to projects that seek to enrich the conversation about religion. To learn more about them, visit templetonreligiontrust.org. This episode is also sponsored by the Institute for Advanced Catholic Studies, a global research center located at the University of Southern California. IACS works to create dialogue, spark ideas, and sustain academic research on Catholic thought, creative imagination, and lived experience. Learn more at iacs.usc.edu. If you're enjoying the show so far, please subscribe to our podcast and take a moment to leave us a review.
The other thing that I found striking is you say this is not really, social fragility is not necessarily about poverty, right? You can have poor neighborhoods that are socially rich and then upper class wealthy neighborhoods that are socially fragile. Could you say more about that?
I'd be happy to. I think we have a problem in our societies that we tend to conflate everything with economics and material. And then when we look for solutions, we tend to get fixated on government policy. And I would say both of those is very narrow thinking. So in terms of, I mean, just think historically, everyone in the world more or less was poor at some point, and yet we all had socially rich lives. So just from a simple common sense, think about it. If I went back 200 years, 98 whatever percent of people in the world were poor, and yet they weren't socially poor. They were economically poor. So it just doesn't make sense that these things are the same. In terms of America today, I mean, you could go to some immigrant. The most obvious example is you go to some immigrant communities. A group comes into the United States, let's say from a part of China or a part of Africa or a part of the Middle East. And they come in there. They might be refugees. They might be pretty poor. But if there's enough of them, let's say hundreds of people or more, they will congregate in a relatively close proximity to each other. They will support each other. They will likely have strong family, interfamily, and some sort of communal institutions, and they will support each other. Some of them are dynamic enough that within a relatively short period of time, they will have what we might call economic takeoff, and they will no longer be socially, economically poor. Some of them will not be as successful economically, but they will still retain the social dynamism. You could just think of like the Amish. The Amish are not rich, but they have their communities are designed to be very communal, very socially rich. And then I would say the contrast is you can go to a lot of well-off neighborhoods today in which no one knows each other. Mm-hmm. Everyone is afraid to talk with each other. Not like they don't feel so bad about it, but they just feel I cannot show vulnerability. I cannot show reliance on other people. It's almost like a norm to present yourself as self-reliant.
Yeah.
And that basically makes you more vulnerable. This idea that you're so self-reliant that you can't be vulnerable actually makes you more vulnerable. It would be so much better if you could go out, develop a few friendships. And I would encourage everybody watching, think about your neighbors, your neighborhood, the place where you live. What would happen if you had at least a few good relationships in that neighborhood, people you would meet? We can live in networks, and some of us do very well in networks, but a lot of us don't do well in networks. A lot of us need social institutions. And to the extent that you live in a materially well-off neighborhood and know nobody there and are afraid to knock on any door, you are to a certain extent socially impoverished. Mm. And you can see the data of the suicide rates and the mental illness affecting people that are materially well off. And I think it's all related to the social vulnerability and social poverty that we are experiencing as a society. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of that, I wonder the extent to which many of us feel like we need to, at least in American society, come across as self-reliant and put on this sort of facade of invulnerability in order to appear successful, right? And that seems to be a kind of norm that we internalize in ways that, you know, I've seen some of this in other countries as well. And I wonder if part of it too is just an urban problem, being in a big city. And, you know, Georg Simmel, the sociologist, talked about even 100 years ago, seeing this kind of pattern of individualization and sort of the sort of blasé attitude that people develop when they move to cities and that kind of disconnection. How much of this is an urbanization problem and how much of it do you think is an American problem?
I think in general, becoming materially better off reduces the thickness of our in social institutions and relationships. So I think there's a material aspect. I think there, you could say there's to some degree an urbanization aspect, except that many people would say that people in urban situations, being more dense, they tend to have a richer social life than being in more isolating rural areas and suburbs. So I think the urbanization part is, I can take a more of an argument with. I think if you go back to Jane Jacobs, and she's thinking 1960s, 1950s, 60s, New York City, her idea of that this is a very organic, socially rich existence. And if you look at the new urbanism movement, the whole premise behind it, which I don't think is, I think it's an incomplete vision, but it is a necessary vision, that if we have more dense, more basically a more dense physical environment, we are likely to have closer social relationships. I do believe that is correct. It's much harder if you're all living a mile apart from each other. I mean, you could gather in the church or some town, and I know so some of that is there. So I'm not quite sure urbanization. I would say the big things that have changed is we've changed, the physical landscape has changed. We went from being, we're actually to some extent less urban because we've all developed these suburbs.
Yeah,
I would say the fact that we don't shop locally, I would say the fact that we don't even pray locally. I would say schools are less, to some extent, less local than they used to be. So just think, there is a problem of course, government. The way government spends money has meant that a lot of nonprofits look upward and outward for money rather than inward and local for money. I think that has had a huge impact. But a lot of it is simply the way we've designed our society. We've designed our society such that there are few, if any, institutions, meeting places in your physical place where you live. Yeah. And if we basically, we used to have, if you think about society, used to be, we used to live in bounded communities. Bounded meaning that there was some physical distance, and that all the institutional life or most of the institutional life was place-based. And so you had overlapping place-based institutions and you had lots of ways people could meet. Clearly the car has had a dramatic impact, but it's also, we've done many things in terms of how we've designed institutions, how we've thought about success, how we've built our landscape that basically have ensured that most Americans don't even live in a place. They live in what I would call a placeless environment in which you might have a house. There might be streets with lots of houses. There might be green areas. I'm thinking 10 minutes from me, they built like this ideal area. Houses are nice. Streets are nice. Lots of places to walk. And there's no place to meet people. Our idea of a beautiful life, if I may say so, is an isolated life where you have your career, you have your house, you have your green, and I think green is great. I live a couple blocks from the woods, but we don't think more than that. So we've basically thought of happiness as being alone.
Yeah.
And then you wonder, being alone, or at least your household being alone, but to some extent, it's about just being alone. And then you wonder why we have loneliness, despair, mistrust. It's all actually natural. We've created a society that promotes these things, and then you wonder how we ended up with them. It's kind of, I don't think it was intentional, but basically the design of the society in terms of institutions and places and everything is basically designed to for the individual to be alone.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about solving this problem. I mean, you argue that the approach that's needed is not top down nor bottom up. It's not a kind of government policy driven solution, nor is it some sort of market driven solution, but sideways. What does that mean? And then I'll love to sort of think through a couple of the examples, but maybe if you could talk about, you know, for starters, how something like Life Remodeled in Detroit is an exemplar of this sort of sideways solution.
I would say that you cannot create relationships with policy. There are some policies or some government actions, which I think could be very important, but they're not the traditional way. We tend to think of policy as something material. We're going to give you more time off from work if you have a baby. We're going to give you more income. We're going to encourage people to work. We tend to think Americans do not realize how atomized their way of thinking is. They tend to think of everything in terms of individuals, and they tend to think of a lot of things in terms of policy, which means material. And I think what we really need to think about are structures. The key thing is here, if we want to address this problem, we need to build structures. And so I'll get to the Life Remodeled example, but the single most important thing is to re-envision our country such that everyone lives in a neighborhood, and to think hard about what it means to create a country full of flourishing neighborhoods. That is like the big vision is if every person lived in a well-recognized neighborhood. And I list, when I give book talks, I list 10 items in terms of an identity, a center, community school, other places to meet, local institutions, you know, all the things you can list. And some of them are just things you would see in any good neighborhood. We need to think about society, a set of neighborhoods, and then we need to work hard to ensure each of those neighborhoods are flourishing. But again, ultimately, what has to happen in society. And when I say horizontal, I mean horizontal on two levels. One is the relationships within a neighborhood. And on a second level, it's thinking across neighborhoods. So it could be relationships between neighborhoods, or that we work simply place by place by place. We don't think of policy, government downward. We don't think of it's nice to have these spontaneous locally led efforts, and that's also great, and we should support that. But we have to think that there's 330 million Americans. There are literally hundreds of thousands of neighborhoods or potential neighborhoods, and we need to think as a country that each of those need to flourish. So the Life Remodeled example was that Detroit used to be a city with very identifiable neighborhoods, like cities that were built before World War II. They followed housing driven because it was probably because of the automobile was built there. But historically, we had a very pre-World War II, and I would say even pre-20th century, we had a very organic model of development. Detroit has partly that, but of course, because of the car, it's like this in between. But it had a lot of neighborhoods. But it also had one of the largest populations in the United States. And then sometime around 1950, it began to go in reverse. And today it has one third of the population it had 50, 60 years ago. So to actually physically go to Detroit and drive around, it's like a landscape that you cannot imagine in many parts of the world, because we basically have most of the world has been seeing population growth, landscape growth. In Detroit, you've had the reverse. You have all these houses that have already been knocked down. If I went there 15 years ago, I would have seen a lot more houses that needed to be removed. Today, you still see lots of houses that are decayed, broken down, but now you see like literally grass. You see grass and trees and blocks with almost no houses. It's almost like a post-war pattern in which the people have been removed and there's some physical stuff left. And so the thing is, this organization chose one neighborhood. It wanted to work on building up that neighborhood. It had done a lot of work in many neighborhoods across the city. It did something called the 6-Day Project, which basically brought a lot of volunteers, up to 10,000 volunteers together to basically remove blight, clean up streets, help fix some houses, give people, in some cases, some help on their houses. A great volunteer effort, but then it wanted to be more systematic. It chose a very particular neighborhood. And it actually made, it had thought it had made good relationships with people in the neighborhood, but because of the nature of its initiative, it was basically offered by the city of Detroit, by the education authorities in Detroit, offered it this incredibly beautiful, talking about beautiful, beautiful building built in the 1920s that was a middle school, and offered them, you can take this building and turn it into a neighborhood hub. And you can bring all these organizations together. And those organizations would be a way of creating more of an institutionalized life. And there'd be lots of opportunities for people in the neighborhood to come together. So this is like a community building as well as a practical helping initiative. And the organization and the leader, Chris Lambert, thought this is great. We ought to do that. Except when they announced it, that they were going to get this property for 50 years for $1, there was a backlash. Mm-hmm. And the backlash was, I think, most importantly, because he was white, he was an outsider, the neighborhood was black. And the key thing to understand is that he, the outsider, thought that he had built trust. Mm-hmm. And building trust to pick up your blight is a different kind of trust than I'm going to take over the most important building in the neighborhood. I'm going to do it for $1. And by the way, no one in the neighborhood was offered the chance to buy this property and do what they're doing. And so people feel like this is going to be gentrifying them out. This is some sort of exercise. So when I write in that chapter, I think that chapter of my book is trying to accomplish a few things. First, it's talking about what does it actually mean to build trust when there's no trust. And he laid out eventually a 5 or 6 step process about literally meeting people, breaking bread, identifying local leaders, hiring local people, doing a variety of things such that his organization managing this beautiful, beautiful site actually became a local organization in a way that it wasn't before. He's still there, and some of their staff are not from there, but many more of the staff are now from there, and they have a couple of advisory boards of people from the neighborhood, one with students because it was a former school, one with you might call senior statesmen or whatever you want to call them from the neighborhood. So they basically now are guided and directed and led by people from the place. And immediately that gives a completely different image of the place and what they focus on. So this chapter was one, discussing this process of building trust. And two, the chapter was talking about how do you actually build community in a place that's so devastated. And it's about building institutions. It's about building places for people to gather. It's about having these institutions cooperate. The term I use is collective efficacy. That you're trying to boost the collective capacity of a place. And it's really hard because there's probably about a 15 or 20% turnover of people, as there are in many, many poor neighborhoods in America. There's some people that are very stable and some people that come and go. And every time new people come, they got to start over again, at least with that part. But they have certainly stability and they've achieved a lot. And they have 39 organizations in this hub, some of them local, many of them not, and doing lots of things that are there to help the neighborhood. But for me, the most important part is the social in addition to the economic.
Yeah, there's also a lot of resonance between this and the other example you give of purpose-built communities in Atlanta, the sort of Eastlake miracle, the revitalization of a distressed neighborhood. And I suppose the model there was a bit different with mixed income housing. Could you talk about that and then the role of this community quarterback in that model?
Yes, thank you. I think in my book, I'll take one step back and answer the question. When I think about what makes a neighborhood thrive, I thought of five different things that matter. One is the physical landscape, and four involve institutions. Mm. And we have to understand that social thriving or flourishing is about the nature of institutions and norms in terms of how people are connected, what people expect of themselves and of others, how people behave. It's not like you just snap your finger and we all have relationships. In my neighborhood, I have friends, but I also have a lot of people I just know. Mm-hmm. And somebody asked me for help, I would do something to help them. I feel comfortable asking them for help. We have WhatsApp groups for carpooling. We have WhatsApp groups for things we don't want, we want to give away. Mm-hmm. We have all these opportunities to meet. So there's a lot of people I know and I share a life with that are not my friends. And that's important. I think it's really important. So that's about institutions. But going back to the physical landscape, and then I looked at community building, the role of school and place, the role of marriage, family, marriage and church, and then the role of interfamily or family structures, but it's very much about interfamily networks, supporting a family that has weak family structure. And so all of those things matter. Now, Purpose Built is the one organization I looked at that tries to make comprehensive change. If you think about the other four examples, it's all relationship by relationship, institution by institution, incremental, and about how to scale up institutional change and norm change around a place. The purpose-built example is about we're going to a distressed neighborhood. So that would not be a materially well-off neighborhood. That would be a distressed neighborhood. And we're going to make a more comprehensive plan. And we're going to focus on three. And the way to do that is those neighborhoods, because they don't have strong collective action, they tend to be in a vicious cycle where the poorest people live there and there's no opportunity. And they tend to be cut off from other parts of the city. And the housing is all low income or poor housing stock. And there's no shopping and no community amenities. So there's a huge vicious cycle here going around that it's really hard for one person to stand up and say, I'm going to make a difference. Mm-hmm. You could do that and you could play some role, but they're trying to do a bigger vision. So they establish a neighborhood or a community quarterback. And that is could be some people from the neighborhood, but it often is stakeholders from around the city because this is focused on urban. I think you could do this on non-urban, but they focus on urban. And the idea is that this quarterback develops a vision. This quarterback develops a strategy for housing. Again, mixed income housing, very important. So this neighborhood becomes not distressed, means very, very high poverty. And most of the housing that goes in there is only for poor, which is not a way to create a flourishing neighborhood. A flourishing neighborhood should have mixed, should have cross-class population, mixed income. Housing is very important to create cross-class. I mean, ideally, you should be cross-politics, cross-class, diverse on many levels. Mm-hmm. I mean, we talk about racial and other religious diversity, but mm-hmm. I think I also mean diversity in terms of personalities, mm-hmm. politics, everything. There's many ways to think about diversity. But the key thing is, from them, they work on the housing stock. They work on the school because the school is incredibly important to attract people to a neighborhood. And they work on what they call community wellness, which is like everything from, I guess, nonprofits you could participate in to shopping, to the gym, you know, lots of things, the YMCA, things for kids to do after school. So again, they're thinking that these are the three elements that will make a neighborhood successful. And if they put enough middle-income housing and they make the school good enough and they work on the physical landscape well enough and then the other community amenities, this neighborhood in 10 years will be will be quite significantly changed. And then they work with the Department of Education, they try to work with different parts of government and different nonprofits and different philanthropy. And it's a model that has worked in a couple of dozen locations across the country. So it's another example of what you can do if you have the resources and the vision to do that.
Yeah, no. I had a chance to visit the Atlanta model a few years ago, and really was quite impressive. What are the big lessons, the big takeaways you want people to glean from these case studies?
I would say there's two levels. I mean, I have my last two chapters. One is operational lessons, and my last chapter is what could each of us do. So on the level of government, the level of nonprofits, the level of philanthropy, or even if you yourself was going to start an initiative, I mean, I think the lessons learned are that first we have to rethink our landscape around place and neighborhoods. That's like this overarching theme. And we need to ensure that every neighborhood is flourishing. So people there feel a stake in their neighborhood and they feel more optimistic about their future. I think you can see a lot of the alienation and the anger and the frustration being driven by people are not necessarily happy where they live, or they're happy on a certain level, but they're just vulnerable, isolated because of the nature of the social dynamics. So to the extent that every neighborhood was socially and economically flourishing, I think you would see a very, very different mood in the country. So that would be overarching. But in terms of, that's certainly something that leaders can do on many levels. But I would talk about the importance of youth. I would talk about the importance, if you're going to do something, you're going to focus on the right population to start with. So even if I was focused on youth, which youth do I focus on? Or if I was going to think at a city level, what neighborhood would I start with? So I will discuss in the book why are some neighborhoods more likely to see progress in the short term than others? I talk about this importance of, for example, religion. Religion could play a much larger role. As part of me myself selling or marketing the book, I literally am reaching out to religious leaders and asking them, basically, why is the church, for example, the church most prominently, what could the church do to heal our social fabric? And there's a few suggestions I have for church leaders. One is think much harder about the role of place. And one, think much harder about what it means to build community. I think too much religion in America is about the sermon and the consumer products. You go in for an hour, 2 hours, you have some need that you have that your church or synagogue or mosque addresses for you. The transaction cost is limited and the religion is not asking too much of you. And that's comfortable for a lot of people. And I think the religious institutions are responding to that, but that's not what our country actually needs. Our country needs, in this day when there's so much alienation and there's so much isolation and there's all these social problems, I think our religious bodies, our churches, our another religious institutions, they need to be building more place-based community, which for me means thickening the social practice, thickening the institutions that are bringing people together. Mm-hmm. I think I'm asking for a more demanding version of faith, not a faith of numbers, but a faith of commitment around people and place. Mm-hmm. And so that would be a very practical thing that I would argue for. On other levels, I think we need to focus on what I would call translocal institutions. If we can find things that work, if you look at my organizations, the one that works on the purpose built, we just talked about, they are now in 27, 28 locations. So they've developed a network, an organization called Communio, working on marriage through churches. Their goal is to basically partner with churches all over the country. I have another chapter on what used to be Partners for Education in Appalachia. They have now, in the last 3 years since I wrote that, they're now Partners for Rural Impact. Mm-hmm. And their goal is to basically create versions of their model in many, many parts of the country. I think we need trans-local organizations. The best would be ways for us to have these neighborhood associations or place-based associational life like we had across the country at one point. Can we reproduce that so that every neighborhood has this rich social institutional life? So, I mean, these are all examples. And just to pivot to what each of us should do, my last chapter ends with, how could you rethink your life? And I think, for example, clearly, I believe family is very important, and we should double down on our commitment to family. But beyond that, in terms of our social engagement and our what we consider it means to be our political or our role as citizens, I think to being a good citizen is not just about national elections. It's about participating locally in your local situation. I think social engagement is not about social media. It's not about advocacy in Washington. It's not about sending a check into some nonprofits. It's about you personally volunteering or participating in some way in a local institution. I'm on the board of one local institution in my community, and I participate and contribute to several others in different forms. And so I think we should rethink our idea of what it means to help society and get away from this. We've overly nationalized and over politicized how we think of change and improvement. And we should think harder about what it is we can do in our neighborhood or in our immediate area in terms of our commitment. And I think all of us can play some role. There's nothing that every person can do something that will help their place and help the people in their neighborhood. No matter how little time you have, there's always something you can do. And sending a check to some faraway place may make us feel good, but it doesn't have an impact on real people in real places. And that's what I advocate for.
Yeah, no, that's really crucial. And I appreciate the fact that you've laid out a number of practical steps that people can take. Do you have any suggestions for universities and those who are educating people? I think we tend to emphasize public policy a lot as a field of study, but the sort of thing you're talking about, this sort of sideways, approach, I don't know if there's this too much emphasis on it. What could it look like for us to cultivate that at the level of higher education?
I would say two things. One is the educational aspect, which you're identifying, is that certainly the coursework or the programs. I mean, there's no programs, or there must be some, but could we create programs geared towards developing better social, civic leaders in our local neighborhoods and communities? Mm. What does that mean? Could we take everything from urban planning to economics to architecture and add an element to them to think about how their work has implications for social life? There's many, many subjects in university in which basically the role of relationships and society plays zero role in the curriculum, even though the type of students that go through there and graduate, what they do in their careers will have enormous impact on social life and society. And yet they're not trained to think that way. So that would be one whole area. I think a second area I would say is universities should marry their neighborhoods or their immediate neighborhoods. Some universities have done this in the last 15 or 20 years. But what does it mean is that university should say, this surrounding area, I have a stake in it. How can the university help the neighborhood? I mean, that would mean everything from helping train people in the neighborhood. That might mean investing in the neighborhood, literally investing in buildings and the development of the neighborhood. That might mean encouraging lots of programs to become practical by having people join local associations and doing things volunteer or for credit in the neighborhood, the more that universities, many of them are very wealthy, many of them are full of educated people, many of them run programs that theoretically ought to be applied in their immediate surroundings, but they're not tested on the ground. All of these things could be leveraged to actually help not only one neighborhood, but several neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. I mean, universities have a stake in the success of wherever they are, and they ought to be acting out on that very proactively.
Yeah,
they're one of the best entry points in terms of institutions because there are strong institutions in neighborhoods often that aren't very strong.
Yeah, and they often don't really engage with them very much at all, right? And
yeah, I mean, they would rather not bother. It's this idea that of most people in our country, let's have a frictionless life. Mm. And so what it means is that we train people to be leaders who don't understand large parts of our country, are divorced from large parts of our country, and somehow, to be honest, they feel entitled because of the school they went to be in a certain upper class or upper middle class of society, and they look down on everybody else. And we are a meritocracy, but the point is, we need to recall this idea of stewardness, and we need to think hard that our flourishing as an individual or as a family or whatever we believe, wherever we are, our flourishing depends upon other people flourishing. And we have a stake in everyone flourishing so that the country will flourish. And people who are scared by what our politics ends up should ask themselves, did they make choices that advance their flourishing, but not other people flourishing? And is that anger being funneled into politics? If we don't look down on other people and we consider it our responsibility to try to uplift other people, I'm a capitalist, so I'm not arguing for anything in terms of changing our economic model, but I do think we need to dramatically change our social model.
Yeah. Fantastic. So do you have any final comments, any final thoughts, any final takeaways from your book that you want to communicate that you haven't shared yet?
I mean, for me, the most important thing, of course, I would love for viewers, listeners to buy the book. I would love if they were to engage in the material. And you can find me if I can help with anything. I'm very active on LinkedIn, and I've been so surprised by the literally hundreds of people who have reached out to me because of some of the content, which is related to my book I've been putting on it. But in terms of last takeaways, I would say do not underestimate your ability to contribute in some way to the place that you live. And we all have a role to play in supporting the success of our neighborhood. And the more we can join, even if it's a volunteer in some association, the more we can make an effort to know our neighbors. I think each of ourselves will have a richer life. And to the extent that we can do more so that our neighborhood is more flourishing or set an example, I think we all have a role to play here to rethink what our country, what does the American dream mean? And what is flourishing in our day and age? And to the extent that we all could do something to shift how we think about things and to proactively live it out as a model to others, we will all make a contribution to help ensure we all live in a flourishing place. So thank you so much.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you, Seth. Flourishing or Fragile Neighborhoods comes out October 17th. So please do buy the book and take a step towards building more beautiful and flourishing neighborhoods and communities wherever you live. Seth, thank you again for joining us. It's been such a pleasure.
Great pleasure. So much a pleasure we could do this. Thank you so much.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this episode of Beauty at Work. Please be sure to check out our show notes for more resources from our guest. And if you like this episode, please be sure to share it with your friends. And please leave us an honest review. We'd love to hear what you think, and it helps to get the word out about our show. Music edited by Venkat Subramaniam, and the podcast was edited by Dave Visaya from Podcast Engineers. And thanks again to our two sponsors, Templeton Religion Trust and the Institute for Advanced Catholic Studies at the University of Southern California. research project on beauty and science, visit wellbeingandscience.com. Learn more about our broader project on beauty at work, visit beautyatwork.net. Thanks again, and see you next time.